The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, number 88, for January 16th, 2007. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton, and I'm back. John is back too.
It took a while.
Yeah, but we're back to winter here. It's cold. I got snow on Sunday. Not much, but enough rain before the snow so that my driveway is currently a sheet of ice. The FedEx truck came in today a little too fast, hit the brakes at the end, and slid about 6 feet before they finally stopped.
Nice. So the kids must be having a blast.
Oh yeah, it's great.
Yeah, so I got back to Connecticut, kind of.
Yeah.
So, of course, if you were flying back from Macworld Expo, you probably ran into that little storm kind of in middle America there.
Yeah, it was the one January in all the years I can remember where it was better to fly through Chicago than Dallas. So, go figure.
Yeah, so they redid my flight, and I experienced one of the first horrors of flying, which I've never had until this point.
You lost your luggage.
Not quite. No, it was delayed. But
yeah.
You get to your end point. You're sitting there. You're at the belt. Everybody's gone except you. And nothing's happening. And you're like, oh, no. So I go to the dreaded baggage office. And I'm like, oh, yeah, it's on the next United flight. I was on American.
Hey, at least they knew where it was.
And give them credit. Yeah, they gave me a little thing. And sure enough, it was an hour and a half later on the belt from the next flight from a competing airline. So...
Hey.
Yeah, it was a mess. I mean, you looked at the board and half the flights were canceled. I'm lucky I made it within a day because a lot of people didn't.
That's right. Talking
to on shuttles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, anyways, but Macworld was a blast. I think you would concur. We saw a lot of cool stuff. But
best Macworld ever.
We got to wind down from that. We got to get back to what we're all about here.
Back to the groove. That's right. This show will be back to your questions. We've got all kinds of stuff. And we've got a new geek challenge, I think, that we'll throw in here and all kinds of stuff. So we will start with one from an unknown caller. When you call, just make sure you introduce yourself at first so that we know who you are so we don't have to go through, all of
this. Handle is cool. You can be Mr. or Ms. or Mrs. X. That's okay.
All right. Well, this is Mr. X.
Hey, John. David Fair from Santa Wanda, South Buffalo. Quick question for you about hard drives. I got a new 400-gig Western Digital SATA drive for my aging G4, and I'm going to put multiple partitions in it. One of them for the primary boot volume, one of them for a scratch disk where for our downloads, because I kind of want to fragment the drive, and another partition for all of our media, podcasts and music and such. Quick question. When I go ahead and set the partition, I was curious as to which one would be the partition that I want to use. You know, you set it up and you can slide the levels down for partitioning and size. And I'm wondering which one is the fastest part of the drive. I know there's a hot band in the OS, and it uses that for boot up applications and such. And I know you want to respect that. Sometimes I'll defrag with idefrag. I know that respects the hot band, but if I choose the wrong one, it's kind of a moot point because I won't even be in the fastest part of the drive. Anyways, any help's appreciated. Thanks again for the awesome show. I look forward to it every week. I can be reached at.
You are oh so kind, and I still couldn't catch your name the fifth time I heard that there. So you want to take the lead with this one, John, or should I run with it?
I'll take the lead on one point, then I'll hand it off here. But there was talk. So first, I guess I am in the school in general, which does not believe in partitioning. I know there have been reasons to do that in the past, as far as, block size or, minimum block size and stuff to get maximum storage capability.
Yeah.
But I just in general try to shy away from it. But one reason, and we'll touch on the colors, but one of his points is that the drive or the OS is kind of doing the work for you, so that's why I lean away from manually you know, doing things like partitioning and optimizing and stuff like that. Now, one thing that was pointed out, the hot band. Now, this is something that I looked into, and I think it's also referred to as adaptive hot file clustering, where under,
that's right,
I guess it would be the underlying BSD OS, or it could be an OS 10 specific thing. Files under 10 megabytes who are not written to for a while, which would indicate that it's probably an OS file or some other file that's not going to change. So, you know, you can probably shuffle it away somewhere and, you know, make access more efficient. But it's put in this place called the hot band, which our, you know, caller referred to. The only thing I can imagine is that this is something you do not want it to feed. You do not want to second guess the OS.
Right.
But as far as from what he said, I would suspect that this hot band thing is not so much, and I think what he was trying to get at, not so much a physical location, but it sounds to me like a logical location. It may be both. I mean, it may, based on the type of drive, say, hey, I know, you know, where I should put this stuff to get faster access.
Sure.
It sounds to me like something the OS is doing to be smart and putting all this stuff in one place. It probably is in an area of the drive that is fast. But that's the other thing that I wanted to get to is that, you know, knowing the fastest part of the drive, I think, is getting to a level that may not be necessary. Again, I think you want to hand it off to the OS. So those are my comments on that, and I'll hand it off to you because I think you have done probably a bit more, you know, lower level type of work here, especially working on Unix, where we're
right,
doing things like this, you know, picking a scratch drive and stuff like that may be more applicable. So to you.
All right. Well, you know, to jump to the Unix part of this, and then we'll get back to OS X. But with Unix, really, if you're going to create a scratch partition, and by scratch I mean swap, and that's different from what our caller's talking about here. But if you're going to do that, you actually want that on a separate spindle altogether. Remember, anything that's on the same spindle has the drive heads jumping all over the place, right? So if you have three partitions on the drive, and one is at the beginning of the drive, one is at the middle, and one is at the end. If you're playing a podcast, let's say, and you've got it on your media partition that's at the end, you're jumping all the way to the end and then back to the beginning to read some OS files, and then all the way to the end to read the podcast and back to the beginning to read some OS files. And there's some caching and all of that that the OS can do and the drive itself can do to keep that efficient. But, you know, in Unix, the idea is if you're going to have two things that are going to be accessed right next to each other, have them on different spindles, and then bam, you're really fast. And really, what you'd have is this one spindle for reading and one for writing, and then that way you're really being efficient, maybe mirroring data between the two in some fashion. But I would agree with you, John. I wouldn't partition a drive because it is going to add that layer of inefficiency, and I think that will outweigh any of the moderate performance gains that might be realized by not having that that scratch stuff. And now we're talking about the scratch stuff as in downloads and temporary data that the caller referred to. As far as the hot band, yeah, from what I recall, I believe that's more of a logical thing where it's picking a part of the drive to be just what you said, that hot band of commonly read but not oft written to files. My advice, though, if you are going to partition the drive, put the boot partition as the first thing on the drive. I know the OS can deal with it further out, especially newer machines. They can deal with it, you know, past the 8 gig mark. I know there was that issue for a while, but I wouldn't mess with it, man. Put the boot partition first. That is what the OS expects. After all, it's seeing, you know, if you only have one partition, well, the boot partition is therefore the first. And from what I can recall, that hot band is somewhere near the beginning of the drive. So I think that's what you're going to want to do. So that's my feeling on that.
Cool. And the other feature that I ran into is kind of an auto defrag, which some of the data I have suggests that for highly fragmented files that are 8 or more fragments under 20 megs in size,
yep,
OS X is also kind of looking around for stuff like that. So, of course, there are utilities. Again, I think my position is, you know, trying to optimize a drive is something that just freaks me out.
Yeah, it can be. You know, you're right. The OS will defragment files, but it won't optimize the drive in that it won't reorder where those files appear to make it more efficient. You can see, especially if you've been through, you know, let's say 5 or 6 OS upgrades, even point up or, you know, incremental upgrades, you're downloading hundreds of megs each time Apple makes, you know, an update to even to, you know, to Tiger, let's say. We've seen, 8 of them now. And those can all start to scatter around the drive because, you know, they're replacing files that were at the beginning of the drive if you even started that way. So to optimize the drive can, in theory, make things faster. But, you know, we say this all the time, and I mean it. Man, if you're going to start messing with stuff like that, shoot a backup first. Don't trust that thing is going to finish. If you're in the middle of moving a very critical file and your machine dies for whatever reason, it's over. That's it. Mm-hmm. You're done. So
game over, man.
Game over. All right, let's hear what Laurie had to say.
Hi, lads. It's Laurie here, calling from Wellington, New Zealand. I've got a couple of questions for you. First one is, I've got an 802.11g network with my AirPort Expresses running through the house, but my web server, which is my dear old Cube, has only got 802.11b. Now, I understand with both those protocols running that slows down the 11g to run about b rates. Is that right? Can you explain what's going on? The other one is, I've got my phone here, which is a Sony Ericsson Z520. Now, every now and again I want to use it with my PowerBook, using the Bluetooth and modem facilities to talk to my network, which is Vodafone. And going through the Bluetooth setup, I can't get it to work. You ever had anything working along those lines? Have a good new year. Bye.
Thanks, Laurie. Okay, I'll take the first part of this here. The important thing to realize is that network speeds, wireless network speeds, are not as advertised. They never are. Theoretically, 802.11g can go 54 megabits a second. Really, what that translates to, best case real life scenario, is 26 megabytes a second, right? 27. I've tested this. This is how this works, right?
So it's all lies.
It's always half is what it turns out to be. No.
Effective,
this is just, yeah.
Real world.
Effective real world. Best case. Remember, it can always be slower if you've got a weaker signal. Best case with 802.11b is 5.5, right? Half of 11.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So knowing that, when you add, and I'll let you explain why this is, but based on all the speed tests that I did, especially when 802.11g was starting to be introduced into Apple products, if you're running 802.11g and that's all you have on your network, you'll get, again, given best case, best signal strength, you'll get your full 27. As soon as you add a B client to the mix and it starts talking, the G client's fastest speed hits about 15. It maxes out there. So you lose a significant chunk. And John, you're going to explain why.
I think
so. You are.
And the reason why is not so much that everybody gets dumbed down, but what they have to do is wrap one packet inside of another.
Okay.
So what they're doing is they're putting the, because they're creating a frame that looks like a B frame, that involves some work. To talk to the B station. So overall, if you're doing that work to create this compatible packet, that is what's slowing. It's not all of a sudden saying, oh, I'm half as fast. It's still as fast in theory. And as you pointed out, the speeds are pretty much lies. I mean, theoretical maximums.
Right.
Not lies. That's nasty.
Yeah.
So what's happening is that because it has to do the extra work to talk both languages, that's what's really killing you.
That's right. Okay. That makes sense. But it's not slowing it. It's important to note that, you know, we're going from a theoretical maximum of 27, a real world maximum of 27 down to a real world maximum of about 14.5, whereas the B is still maxed out at 5.5 real world. So, you're not slowing all the way down there, but you are slowing down significantly. So it's important to note.
And it was, you know, it's on the same frequency, and that's a benefit, you know, cost-wise, I think, especially because you don't have to come up with a new RF section or a wildly new RF section to do that. And then the second question, now refresh me on the...
All right, he's having trouble getting his Sony Ericsson phone to talk to essentially to act as a modem via a Bluetooth connection. And really, okay. I think the trick there is to find a to make sure your provider allows your phone to support that. And assuming that answer is yes, right. You've got to get the right GSM scripts, modem scripts for your Mac.
Yes.
And then also figure out exactly what numbers to dial and all that stuff. And every network is different in every area. So I can't even begin. I don't know the answer for Lori's specific problem. I barely know the answer for mine. In fact, I had to take screenshots of mine once I got it set up. Because how often do you look at that stuff?
Yeah. No, and I hit upon it once too with the Motorola V710 and Verizon.
Mm-hmm.
Verizon. Actually, as of late, they all suck. I mean,
this is true. Yeah.
But I believe with them it was a #77, and then particular login related to your wireless number and the password, and it would do like kind of a high speed DSL like connection. But they didn't really advertise this fact anywhere, certainly not on their page. You had to go elsewhere.
Right.
So I think a similar situation, you may have to go through covert channels to find out exactly how to do this with your provider. And as you pointed out, Dave, the script is important. Actually, in my case, even though it was a Motorola phone, the script that seemed to work with OS X was a Sprint PCS phone script for some bizarre reason. But one file I read said, use this script, don't worry, it'll work, and it worked. So.
Yeah. Who knows?
But yeah, that's one area of networking that could use some help. I mean, Bluetooth is great, but the scripting and the magic hand wave you have to do for each provider kind of stinks.
Yeah, it sure does. All right. Well, you all know to come here and get your answers for your Mac questions. But if you have a relative that's not quite as technically inclined, or you want to get some of this stuff and archive it, TeachMac, of course, is one of our sponsors, and TeachMac, available at teachmac.com, is an application in which you can download modules that will teach you things. And these modules can be audio, video, text, and a combination of all three. The video can actually go to full HD resolution. Everything's native in there. You get the opportunity to see a list of all the topics. The application, you can download the application for free, browse all the modules, and then when you want to download something, if the module is free, well, down it comes. If not, you pay for it, and they're cheap. You know, they're usually in that $5 to $15 range. Very, very much. Anywhere from free to $15. That's right. Yeah. Very, very. It's a great environment to use to teach people things and also learn things for yourself. Of course, you can create your own modules. You can create, I don't know what just happened there with the mic. You can create your own modules. And if you do, you can tag them as Mac Geek Gab and support everything we've got going on here. So that's all available at teachmac.com. Devin called 206-666-GEEK, and we are going to hear what Devin had to ask.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Devin the Mackey. I'm calling from Cincinnati. I am running OS 10.4.8. I recently did get an external hard drive as a gift and wanted to start backing up my Mac. So I downloaded .max backup software and started backing up. And I noticed that the incremental backups ended up adding up to more and more space. And I would periodically have to do a full backup and delete the previous increments. So I wanted a better way to get more of a mirror, and I wanted to do this freely. Without cost. So I downloaded a program called PSync X, and I created several mirror folders on this backup drive to mirror certain folders on my Mac. Now, when I did this, the first thing I noticed was that one of the folders, for instance, my applications folder, which I happen to mirror on the backup drive, on my Mac takes 5 gigs, and on the backup drive takes 9.5 gigs. And when I look at the number of bytes under the get info, it's 5,000 million bytes on my Mac, and it gives me the same number of bytes on the backup drive. However, it lists it as 9.5 gigs. So I wanted to know if you knew what was up with that.
You know what? Let's stop right there and talk about a little bit of this, because I think we're going to get into some more stuff potentially with Devin as we go on, but I don't want to lose what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. So we'll start from the beginning of where we were. .Mac backup, yeah, it sucks. It doesn't do what you would expect it to do. The incremental backups never refresh, and in order to refresh them, you've got to go and delete everything. It's not at all intuitive, and yes, it will back things up, but it's not going to work the way you want. So
Should be every file that changes since the last time you did something.
It is, but you can't tell it, look, do an incremental backup for a week and then reset the backup and go back to the beginning. It'll just keep adding to this incremental thing.
Is it incremental against the original?
No, it's incremental against all the change sets, but it never, you can't tell it to reset, right? You can't tell it to go back and do a full backup again. You get what I'm saying? So you'll just get these, it just constantly builds on itself, and it'll finally get to the point where it's useless.
I think what I was saying is that when you do the incremental, it doesn't reset the whatever. It doesn't know that the next incremental is...
No, it does. It does. What I'm saying is you can't refresh, okay? You can't... Okay. You're only... Once you start, you can only do incrementals. You can't do a full backup and then incrementals from that again.
Okay.
Okay, so it's a pain, right? So PSYNC is fine. PSYNC X is fine for what he wants to do. I like retrospect, but yes, it is backwards. There's Mac back as well. There's all kinds of stuff available out there, but PSYNC is fine. All of them, when doing a mirror like he describes, are going to yield the same problem, and that's where files may appear to be a different size. You want to talk about that, or should I keep going?
Files a different size. I think we were touching on that before when we were talking about partitioning.
Block sizes. That's right.
I think is that a block? You know, so a drive has one unit of info. I don't know, we'll call it a sector or whatever. Yep. But at some level, the drive has a unit that's the smallest that it really knows how to talk to. Now, the problem is it may be larger than the smallest size you can imagine, which is, you know, like a byte. So right. It's going to make a block that's 1K, 2K, 4K, so on and so forth. And if the block size, this minimum block size, is much larger, which in this case it sounds like, then a file, you'll physically be taking up that much space on the drive. So you'll take up, however, let's say a block is 1K. You may take up 8K, 8 blocks of 1K each, but maybe the file is less than that. But right. You'll still take it up because the block size is
a certain size. So let's say a smaller drive has a block size of, like John said, let's say it has 8K blocks. A 4K file is going to take up that full 8K block. If a larger drive may have a block size of 32K or 64K, that 4K file will take up 32K or 64K. However, I thought HFS Plus really gave us a lot more room to work with here. So it's possible that this external drive that he's using is not HFS Plus formatted.
Oh, maybe want to reformat it.
Yeah, that would be my guess. Or perhaps it's FAT, maybe FAT32, even though that got better with this too. This is not a problem I've seen creep up in a long time. So I'm thinking that the format method of the drive, or the format of the drive, may be at issue here. So.
Yeah, because the newer formats, I think, as you're suggesting, usually take this into account and make the size pretty small.
Yeah.
You're not wasting all this space.
You're not wasting all that space. But that sounds exactly like what's happening. So, all right, let's move on and see if we can't nail the next thing here.
And my second question is, I did still have to use backup to back up my documents and settings because, first of all, I don't know where those files are on the drive. And if I wanted to restore them, I wouldn't know how to do that. So I stuck with backup because it knows how to do all those things. So I'm using a combination of PSYNC X and the backup software. But the problem with this is I opened up console because I noticed that my scheduler in PSYNC X wasn't mirroring it when I asked it to as far as the schedule goes. And looking under console, when it tries to run the scheduled backup, which it does try to do, gives me an error that says a sync server is already running on this computer, exiting process, which I'm assuming must be the backup software for my documents and settings. And I wanted to know if there's a way to get around this or if you could use more than one scheduling type software for your backups on a single Mac. That is my second question. My email.
All right. It's odd that PSYNC X would try and use the same service that .Mac Backup uses, but I guess it's possible. And if that's the case, then I would not schedule it internally to PSYNC X and go with that launch D thing that you found, John, which is? I'm putting you on the spot here, aren't I?
Yes, you are.
All right. Well, John's going to look that up quickly. There is the launch D service.
Lingon. L-I-N-G-O-N is a utility that lets you mess with your launch D jobs, both the built-in ones, and you can make others. I guess it's the launch D is the thing that takes over all the other launch services. They try to lump them all together in this new, improved, I think, utility.
Yeah, so it's a replacement for cron, essentially, in the old Unix days. But in a nutshell, it allows you to schedule events that happen whenever you like them to, and presumably we could get PSYNC X to do that. So that would be my thought on that. Or just go ahead and get something like Retrospect. And, you know, I mean, it all comes down to how much time you're willing to put in versus how much money you're willing to spend. And Retrospect's going to require some time just to grok the interface, but it's well worth it in my mind. So,
you know, I just came up with, I was looking at my console. I have a sync server is already running on this computer.
I see that all the time. Yeah.
That seems to be a common error.
That may not be the issue, you know, because I see that on mine and I'm not running PSYNC X either. It's possible that you've got another PSYNC X problem and another scheduling issue. It could be the same thing. I don't know. But either way, Lingon may just solve it just by brute forcing your way through it. So.
Yep.
What else? Right on to Doris.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Doris calling from Toronto, Canada. Happy New Year.
Thanks.
I'm calling you because I have a major problem. I've only found one answer online and probably had some help from my brother, but it just doesn't seem to work, and I am very nervous. But suddenly, my iMac G5 is suddenly on the Finder. It's rebooting itself. It's flickering. The menu bar is flickering. And then it shuts down. So it's shut down three separate times now. Once was two times in a row within 20 minutes of each other. So my brother, who is equally a Mac geek, suggested that I go to Disk Utility in OS and do a repair permissions, which I had done, not thinking that I had been loading several new programs from the Mac app a day, and seemed to solve the problem, but then 3 days later, it just shut down by itself again. The one thing I found online was that it said to delete my preferences in my library. There was two of them that it told me to delete, which just misplaced the paper, so I don't know where it is. I'm always nervous about deleting something as major as a preference in your library, so I backed everything up. I'm still hesitant to do it. I'd like to hear from you guys to know what the best route is on solving my problem, that and avoiding going to some actual technician and paying them $120 an hour. I do have a second question. My second question is...
All right. Let's, good call.
Dude, that is so cool.
What's that?
I wish my machine would do that.
Yeah, that's not
just
so good.
Just kind of randomly flicker the screen and reboot? I mean, that sounds pretty exciting. I mean...
Yeah. Okay, so I'm not sure... She said it's either rebooting or it's shutting down, and she said both.
The flicker part...
Yeah,
bothered me. Spontaneous rebooting to me at the very least.
That screams hardware.
To me a hardware problem.
Yeah, it does.
If you're having the machine getting cranky and rebooting a power supply, maybe.
Yeah, the only thing in software that I think it could be is the power management unit. So it's possible that simply resetting the PMU will do it, and we can put a link in the show notes to how to do that on an iMac G5.
There's the PMU. There's also the NVRAID, a few different locations of memory. But, yeah, I'm curious what's causing it.
The system management unit, I guess, is what it's called. And on that particular machine, you restart, force shutdown. Yeah, there's a whole big thing. We'll put a link in the show notes.
The one thing I would suggest, and the Apple people do this a lot of times when you call it AppleCare, which is a pretty good value, I think.
I agree.
For portables, maybe not desktops.
Yeah.
But create a new user and see if this happens.
Very good.
Go to System Preferences, Accounts. I think that's where you go.
Yeah.
And create a new user, see if it happens. And that's worked for me in the past. If it doesn't happen with a new user, something that you've done intentionally or unintentionally has created a terrible combination of software that just does this. But
I've seen this issue.
I don't know, flickering, it sounds like the screen's resyncing, which...
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, flickering just is bad to me.
I've seen this issue with the... with a damaged Finder prefs file. So home, library, preferences, com.apple.finder.plist. If that file's unwritable or is damaged, that can certainly cause strange problems like this. Mm-hmm. The fact that you repaired permissions and then it worked for a couple of days, that kind of leads me to hope maybe that, it's something like that. But still, it could have been a cool couple of days and then it heated up again in the environment where the computer is, and then you're done. So, my guess is that it's hardware, but it's possible it's one of the things we mentioned here. So,
yep.
Shall we hear the second half of her question here, John?
Indeed.
All right. Moving right along. Back to Doris.
It's really, I don't know if it's a quick one or not, but I was wondering if you guys can either do a topic on your show about doing a home network.
You want to do that now, John, or should we do that another show? I think that's time for another show.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So home network, all right, you get a piece of paper, get a pen. We'll save it for another show.
That's right, we will. But that's actually a good topic.
It's a big topic, but it is for the uninitiated. Usually when you get Apple stuff and you plug it in,
it just works.
It works. Yeah. But sometimes you may need a little nudge. Now, just today, speaking of networking, I did have a chance to look at the new Apple 802.11n base station. It looks like an Apple TV. It's not a spaceship anymore.
It does.
So
that's right.
You spaceship owners for the prior Apple wireless base stations, you got a collector's item.
Yep. Yep. All right. So, send in your questions for the whole home networking on your Mac thing. If we get enough of them, we can put together a show and sort of guide it in the direction that you folks want us to go. So send them in too.
Where'd you stumble? Where? Well, send or call.
Well, they can call 206-666-GEEK.
Geek.
Right, which is 4335.
4335.
Yep. Or email MacGeekGab at MacObserver.com or Skype them in. We only check that every couple of weeks, but Skype them into MacGeekGab. And that's that. So we have another interesting question somewhat related to this one, but with a different answer, at least from my point of view.
Hey, John. Hey, Dave. This is John from California, LA specifically. Love the show. Here's an audio question or help need. Maybe you can help me with. I have a G5 Dually, 2.7 gigahertz, non-Intel G5 tower, and all running great. Everything's up to date. However, recently I've been experiencing some shutdown stalls where the machine goes to the blue screen and hangs. The little rotating circular thing is still animating and working great. It just spins and spins and spins and never shuts off. So I have to hold the power key down for, 4 seconds and the whole thing shuts down. I've repaired the disk permissions. I've run Disk Warrior. I've run Mac Janitor. I've done, zap the PRAM. I've done all the things we good little power users do when things like this occur. Yet now I'm stumped. A friend of mine has an iMac G5 non-Intel, and he's having the same issues. And we're both up to date on system. And here's what we have in common. We both have BlackBerries, and we use Pocket Mac to sync. And that's where it stops right there. That's the only similarity there is other than our operating systems. I have no idea if that has any connection or not. Regardless, if you have an answer or a theory, would love to hear it.
All right, well, let's chase the Pocket Mac issue here.
I think that software is a piece of junk, and that's the problem, and we can...
Wow.
Right to the point, man. I mean, it's...
Have you used it before?
No.
It's oh, just, okay. Oh,
so, no. Anyways, certainly a common thread, but let's do a maybe a more thorough...
Well, no, it's possible that that's it, right? Because if the Pocket Mac, sync program is going to... Or the Pocket Mac environment is going to need to leave something running all the time on the Mac to see when you plug your BlackBerry in and tell it to sync. So it's possible that this little app isn't responding to the quick command that's being issued to it by the OS.
Yeah.
Right? It's possible.
Now, I'm just trying to think, is there a handy little utility that maybe hangs out in the menu bar that one could use to bring up a list of running processes where you could see if one is perhaps not responding?
Well, I mean, you could run Activity Monitor from the Utilities folder, right?
Or our favorite, Menu Meters.
Menu Meters, right.
The same thing.
Yeah.
But I've seen this in the past. Like, actually, I'm having a little issue, which I'm trying to figure out with SpamFire.
Okay.
Where all of a sudden something very similar happens is that the system kind of wedges. It seems like nothing's happening, and I go to Menu Meters, ask it to bring up Activity Monitor, and SpamFire is... not responding. And it actually, I'm not sure when they did this, but it's nice. But in Activity Monitor, it shows it in red.
That's
it's
right.
It's an application that's yeah. kind of cranky because it's, who knows. So I think one recommendation is look at your, process list in Activity Monitor and see if anything is coming up as obviously not responding. If it's the utility that you're using or something else, then there you go. That's the
yep.
problem. Now, how to solve that, that's...
Well,
that gets to another level of problem solving.
What I would do, with troubleshooting, I've found you got to trust your gut sometimes, right? So pull up Activity Monitor, sort by name, find everything and anything that has to do with Pocket Mac, since you think perhaps that's it, and quit them all. Force quit them all. Make sure they are gone. Once they're gone, try shutting down your Mac. So, rule that, either decide that that's it, and you'll know right away, or rule it out, right? Because if it doesn't shut down, then okay, it's not Pocket Mac. At that point, other things that could cause your Mac not to shut down, I would run something like Onyx or Cocktail at macOS10cocktail.com and clean all the caches, scrub everything out. It's possible you've got something lingering there. Yes, that stuff is supposed to be deleted on shutdown, but in fact, if you've got, again, a damaged file or something out there that can't be, the OS may, stop in its tracks, essentially. You could also try watching with a terminal session, but, of course, you're past that point, so it's probably already going to have closed out terminal by the time it tries to do that.
Yeah, or another thing is patience, Grasshopper.
Yeah, there is that. That's right. Yeah, sometimes it can take a long time.
It may be, but I've had shutdowns where everything seemed to be just great. It was just...
Mm-hmm.
Either, cleaning a cat, doing what it should be. So don't always, jump to the conclusion the machine is not functioning properly.
Yep.
It may just be doing its thing. So, give it a minute. And I've had this happen. I think you may have too.
Sure.
Where sometimes shutdown doesn't, snap to it because something's going on. I'm not going to second guess it because I may make matters worse.
Yes, that's right. And that's almost a certainty that if you mess with that stuff while it's in process, you will almost always make things worse. So,
but hey, if you do that, then the good news is you can call in to us and
let us know. So, all right,
if you can,
that's right. So, Chad presents an interesting thing, and he suggests that it might be a geek challenge. We're going to augment it a little bit at the end and see if we can't solve a problem that we've been asking for a long, long time. Take it, Chad.
I've got a potential geek challenge for you. My apologies if this has already been covered, but I've been listening to the podcast for a few weeks now. I've got a network-attached storage device, the HP Media Vault, where I store all of my MP3 files. I've got four computers in the house, all running iTunes, that look to that network-attached storage and play music from it. Now, one of them is kind of my management Mac that I use to rip all my new CDs and put on that NAS device. And its iTunes folder looks to the network-attached storage folder where all my music is. The problem I've got is every time I add CDs via that computer to the network-attached storage, I have to remember what CDs I've added so that when I fire up any other Mac in the house, I have to go in there, manually find them, drag them into iTunes, and add them into either a playlist or the general library. What I would like is a way for any of the other Macs to have either a smart playlist, which I haven't figured out how to make work yet, or some sort of automator script, maybe, that keeps looking to that NAS drive, and anytime it sees something new that's not already in a current playlist or a current library, it adds it, so that I don't have to keep bring, oh, I just downloaded this song, or oh, I just ripped that CD and add that to two or three other Macs in the house. Is there any way I can do that with my current setup using an external hard drive? Thanks.
Yeah, man. So that's the question right there, right? Because that begins to solve the I want my iTunes library in one place, but accessible from multiple computers and not stuck managing it through the shared iTunes interface. I think you've stumbled onto the path here. So that's the challenge we throw out to all of you. Is there something that we can do with an automator script, or maybe even something a little lower level, that watches that folder, and anytime something new is added, tells iTunes to go and add that new stuff, and perhaps even put it in. A new playlist, right? So that, or, you know, a playlist that you would know to watch so that you can then go and categorize it on that machine as you see fit. You know, something like what Acquisition does, right? When you download something, it feeds it in and puts it in a playlist. We just need to grab that part of it. I think this would be huge. I know it would sounds be for like, me. Yeah.
Sounds like with the right automator actions, it may be possible.
That's right.
Though I
That's
haven't right. really delved into it that deeply to know if there's a update. You know, everything.
Well, yeah, you want to update everything, but not duplicate what you've got in there, right? I mean, right, that would be the trick. And I know iTunes can do some of that folder scanning, but it's a little weird, at least in my experience. Tell me if you found something different. So that's all I got.
The Geek Challenge. Since I don't have Echo, I have to make my own.
Try it again, John. We'll see what we can do for you.
Okay, the Geek Challenge.
All right, there you go. Perfect.
Better. Thank you.
You got it. That's what I'm here for. All right. I think we're on our way out. If
oh,
I'm
the
not mistaken.
Band. Oh my it's, gosh! It's, you left them outside this whole time.
It's cold out there. It's like 12 degrees outside.
Did you give them anything to eat?
I get to go back to the house, John, and snuggle up and watch my new Series 3 TiVo.
Oh, you got it. You're part of the cult. Good.
You know
good,
what, man?
Good.
And I was taking that terrible, sadistic Motorola box Comcast thing out.
Thrust upon you by the cable company.
Thrust upon me by the heathens at the cable company. And I was looking at it, and it's like, you know, and I said to Lisa, I said, this box is now dead to us, you know, and... but then I realized, you know, this poor thing, we've given this box so much grief in looking at it, right? Looking at the front and looking at the back, it's the same thing as the TiVo box. It looks, other than, you know, some cosmetics, it has all the same buttons and all the same ports on the back as the TiVo box. So why? Oh, why?
Why does it suck?
It's the software. Right? I mean, it clearly, it's the software that sucks. And I know that now that I've done this, Comcast, within about 3 or 4 months, will come out with the TiVo software on their boxes that they've been threatening to do for the last 18 months, and I just can't wait anymore.
Yeah, but hey, be happy in the fact that it's yours.
Yeah, you know, one thing I noticed on this Comcast box, it was so obsessed with us watching live TV that it's total focus. When a show finished recording, if you were watching something, even if you were watching something else, it would pop a note up on the screen and say, "The show has finished recording." It's like, who cares? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't. That's not relevant to me. And then even worse, it had dual tuners, but if you were watching the show that was being recorded and changed the channel, it would say, "Well, if you change the channel, it's going to cancel the recording." Uh-huh. Whereas with the TiVo box, it was smart. I watched it. I changed to the tuner that was recording a show, and I changed the channel. There was no fanfare. There was no notification. There was nothing. It just switched channels. Now, behind the scenes, it switched tuners so that it wouldn't lose what it was recording, because I didn't tell it to stop recording. It just
I don't care.
That's right. That's the difference.
Do what I ask.
Yeah, just do what I ask. But behind the scenes, also do what I want. Read my mind, and it does it. So I'm happy to have it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who's hosting this?
Cashfly is hosting this podcast. Yeah. And the podcast marketplace, of course, is the 6i Isolator earphones from Edemotic, the A5 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, TeachMac from TeachMac.com, and Yojimbo from Barebone Software.
Ooh.
The Backbeat Media Podcast Network is the place to reach us to sponsor this show, though we are pretty close to sold out, if I'm not mistaken. So, go ahead and fill out those iTunes comments. Do all that great stuff for us.
Podcast Alley.
Vote on Podcast Alley.
They're fun, too.
That's right. 206-666-4335. Spells?
Geek.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, we're out of here.
Are we?
I think so. We have more Gmail invites than we can shake a stick at, so feel free to send them our way. But send us audio comments, too. We love the audio comments.
We got a big stick.
Yeah.
But we tried not to shake it too much.
No, I tried to shake the stick at a broadside of a barn once. It didn't work.
And you know what happens? You don't want to shake your stick too much, because if you shake your stick... shake your stick.
Don't. Certainly don't shake it at the broadside of a barn. And don't get caught.
Made on back.
It's good to have all this stuff back. It's nice to be back here.
We're back.